Good morning. The House Education Committee, there we go, will come to order. It's Friday, March 21st. It's 8.05 a.m., and today we are joined by Representative Seaton, Representative Sadler, myself, Representative Gaddis, Representative Reinbold, and Representative Ledoux. On our agenda this morning, we have HB 45, Electronic Bullying in Schools, and HB 365, Performance Scholarship Qualifying Exam. So, with no further ado, we'll begin with HB 45, sponsored by Representative Costello. And if she'll come forward and present the bill. There is invited testimony. I'm not sure if they're online for this bill, but we'll wait for the sponsor to call them, and we'll move forward. So please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Mia Costello. I represent District 20 and members of the committee. Good morning. And with me this morning is Sarah Page, my legislative aide. So this legislation before you is a definition change. It simply adds some words into a phrase of the statute to include electronic when it comes to bullying and harassment. And as a mother and as a former teacher and as an elected official, I see that in our society we have a huge dependence now on electronic devices. We use phones, Facebook, computers, and so do our students. And so what this bill is intending to do is to add some acknowledgement that there is also electronic communication that goes on among our students. And with that, Madam Chair, if my aide could go through the bill.
Sure. And I'd like to notice Representative Quito has joined us. And please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning. For the record, my name is Sarah Page, staff to Representative Costello. In the first section of this bill, we're removing the specification of whether verbal or physical. Thank you. So basically, we are just addressing harassment, intimidation, or bullying at any cost, not specifying what type of communication it is. And in the second section of the bill, we're adding electronic as a form of communication in between written and oral. And online, we have Amelia Davis, the student from Diamond High School, who came up with the idea for this bill. So I think if she's prepared to...
And we don't have her yet, but it's still early. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we have any questions. Representative Ledoux.
Is this bill going to cover conduct that a student does with respect to, let's say, Facebook, which is otherwise not illegal?
Representative Costello.
Representative Ledoux through the chair. The bill before you does not comment on Facebook specifically, and so it really doesn't address a student's ability to be on Facebook.
No, I realize that, but I'm talking about electronic bullying in general. And I guess I'm just sort of thinking about Facebook. We could be talking about Twitter. We could be talking about texting. We could be talking about any of those sorts of things. Is it attempting to make conduct for a student punishable that is not otherwise illegal? So in other words, if you're making somebody's life miserable by saying nasty things about them through some sort of electronic communication, not threatening them, you know, physically, but you're saying Mia Costello is ugly and she's fat, and you keep saying that. Not that I mean that. I'm just using that as an example.
I hope that doesn't get tweeted.
Or Gabrielle Ledoux is ugly and fat. Or that Now, that conduct is not normally illegal. There's nothing illegal about making somebody's life miserable like that. And so what I'm getting at is this bill going to make comments like that, which are said off campus? I mean, I can see that if you're in school and somebody is meanly teasing somebody all the time, that it seems appropriate that the school authorities eliminate that sort of conduct. I'm not sure how appropriate it is if you are off school premises and it's in the evening for the school district to be regulating what you say.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I certainly appreciate your question because as we worked on this legislation, those types of questions did come up, and I would just want to point out in Section 1, so what this legislation is requiring is that if you're an employee of the school, a student, or a volunteer, and you witness this or you have reliable information that someone has been subjected to harassment, that you are to report it. And so essentially what we're saying is that the communication, for example, I volunteer in my children's schools. If I were to witness this, then if this were to pass, I would have to report it to school officials. And Madam Chair, we do have available somebody from the Department of Law who could talk then about what would happen in a legal context with this issue.
Okay, good. Well, when we'll get to that, we have a couple other questions. Representative Sadler.
Representative Costello, you're going to probably have to answer some questions just about bullying laws in general before we get to the specifics of the cyberbullying. But just so I assume you've done some more understanding of how bullying policies work, does simple expression of dislike constitute bullying? Certainly in you know, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, the simple expression, you know, I don't like Susie. It's probably protected speech, but it also can be emotionally damaging when you're 13, 14, 15 years old. So it's just simple expression of dislike. Or can you speak just in generally about what constitutes bullying?
Sure. Representative Sadler, through the chair, again, I would like to point to the language in the bill because it is currently in statute. So in Section 2, harassment, intimidation, or bullying means an intentional written, currently right now, oral or physical act when the act is undertaken with the intent of threatening, intimidating, harassing, or frightening the student.
So would it be your interpretation that, you know, I don't like Susie, it constitutes a threat, intimidation, harassment, or fear-mongering, or frightening?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, if this legislation were to pass, all I would expect that would happen is that if somebody were witnessing something that they felt in their judgment was harassing or intimidating, they would then have to report it to the school. And in fact, we do have districts that have bullying policies within their schools. And for example, in Anchorage, they have a policy that says that they don't condone it. So at that point, it would be up to the administration and the teachers and the parents and the student to really decide whether that warrants some sort of, you know, condemnation of some sort.
And Representative Costello, I see this bill is certainly raising the conversation that says, you know, we recognize that bullying in our schools, whether it's electronic, whether it's in person, written, I got to tell you, we as adults at times could take a lesson in bullying as well. So, and I like the fact that the conversation is being, that we are having this. And I know that when I was on the Mat-Su School Board, we discussed the same thing. And quite frankly, bullying, after, I'm not going to say how many years I've been out of school, but I have spoken to people that I guess I must have known that they were bullied, although when I was in the mix, especially in high school, I may not have partaken, but I didn't do anything to stop it. And I feel pretty badly myself after all these years speaking to some of my classmates, recognizing what it has done to their lives. So I think it's a bigger thing than just somebody didn't like somebody, but I think that it can really pave the path to where somebody may end up going, and inadvertently by us not getting involved and saying, hey, that's not right. You know, that's not correct. We're not going to do that, versus dogpiling on somebody. So the conversation in itself is very important. Representative Quito.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Costello, for bringing this forward. I think it's a very important issue, especially because we don't have the ability to regulate electronic media, and if people in schools can see situations where people are being bullied, that they have an avenue to actually report. In your research in developing this bill, are there similar statutes or laws that would allow, say, a parent who has a concern about somebody being bullied but it's not associated with the school? I mean, maybe a school official has not seen or been able to report it, but the parent has seen that. Is there an opportunity that parents have to say, my daughter or my son is being bullied on Facebook? Can they go to the police, or are there other places where they can go to actually get some support for that?
Representative Costello.
Through the chair, Representative Quito.
Please introduce yourself, because there's some people that are just listening. So.
Okay. For the record, again, my name is Sarah Page. I don't know if there are currently places where parents can go, but I think if this bill is put into place, then they can report to at least the school administration that their child is being bullied online. And it's basically saying that this electronic communication is evidence, although it's outside of school time, it's evidence that it's threatening their educational environment. Okay. So they can bring it forward to the schools.
Representative Ledoux.
You know, I think this discussion is important. I think bullying can have really serious consequences on people's lives. But I also think that we actually need to be fairly careful about where we draw the line with respect to the First Amendment. I mean, the First Amendment and freedom of speech, it allows you to be pretty mean to people as long as you don't go over a certain line. Now, if you're in school, I mean, you don't have during school time that same amount of leeway, because the school officials, of course, have the right to keep discipline in the schools, and they should be. But how far do we want to extend the right to discipline somebody for just being a mean jerk outside of school time? And I've got some problems with that.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair. And I appreciate you taking this seriously, because I do too. I take this subject quite seriously, and without adding electronic to the statute, what we're doing is we're not recognizing that in our society now we use these methods of communicating. And so currently in statute, if it's written or oral communication, we have a responsibility as volunteers in the schools and students, if they see anything, or teachers, administrators, to communicate that with the school. What happens at that point is not what this bill addresses, but what the bill is trying to address is we're trying to say that we want a positive culture in our schools for students, and there are legal ramifications for those incidences that rise to that level. This legislation is saying that if we are going to identify that written and oral ways of harassing and intimidating people are something that you have to report. So now, if this were to pass, we are saying that electronic would be included in that.
Thank
Representative
you.
Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. looking at the bill the way it's constructed, I'm kind of taken in that we're talking about somebody harassing, but in the bill as I read it, it's not talking about somebody harassing somebody else. It's a student being harassed. And so it's really not a report of some student's behavior in harassing, but it's a report that a student has been harassed and is either interfering with their education or there's physical harm or something. Am I misreading the bill, or is that the correct interpretation, that this is a report that there is harm to a student, not necessarily that you are pointing out the particular person that may be causing that harm?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. Again, my name is Sarah Page, and I think in the final part of section one, where it says they shall report the incident, I think both sides of the case will be reported, both the person who is inflicting the harassment or intimidation and also the person receiving it. Of course, the person receiving it or a parent or school administrator will be reporting on that person's behalf, but both the actions of both students will be addressed.
To follow up.
And Representative Seaton, we do have invited testimony that I think that today is a school day, so I want to be sure that they can get in and out. And so I would like to hear from Amelia Davis. Amelia, are you with us?
Yes, hi.
And were you in school?
Yes, I am. At the moment, I'm sitting in a counselor's office, and my teacher has also graciously let me come and talk to you guys.
Thank you so much. And if you'll please introduce yourself for the record.
All right. My name is Amelia Vasquez Davis. I'm a 15-year-old sophomore at AJ Diamond High School, and I'll be testifying on my own behalf. All right. So the law was great when it was made. However, now there's internet and there's social networking, and so therefore there's a loophole in the law. And we can't let the loophole go unfixed. It needs to be patched up. If it remains with a loophole in it, then people will continue to be harassed, and it just can't go. At the moment, there are 19 other states that contain this cyberbullying bill. And it's been proposed to the federal in 2009, which I think would be great. However, Alaska does not have a cyberbullying bill. And about 43% of kids have been bullied online. 1 in 4 says it's happened more than once. 70% of students report that they've seen online bullying. Over 80% of students regularly use a phone. They have about 68% of teens think it's a problem. And if like 90% of kids have a phone and about 80% of them are saying that they're being bullied, I'm pretty sure this is a problem. Okay, about 58% of kids say that they've heard mean or hurtful things to them online, and about 4 out of 10 say that it's happened more than once. And 75% say that they've visited a website that they've seen someone else being harassed online. And I don't know how you guys are seeing this, but the way that I'm seeing it, I'm seeing that it's a problem. I'm seeing all this conflict going on. I'm seeing people getting hurt. I've seen what happens when people get bullied online. It's painful to watch people. They have so many people get depression because they get bullied. People have anxiety. They have just so many problems because they see what happens online. And it's not like it just stays online. Other people see it, and when other people see it, it becomes a problem, and it becomes bullied in person. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I heard someone talking. All right, so when people get bullied online, it comes into the schools. When it comes into the schools, it affects learning. When it affects learning, we cannot be taught as well, so there's problems. People get in fights over social networking so many times. It's happened more than I'd like to say. And that's how I would like to start my testimonial.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We don't have any questions at this. Whoops, we do have questions. Representative Sadler.
I would like to ask a question. Thanks, Ms. Davis, thanks for calling in, and thanks for your idea. A question for you. At Diamond High School, what's the policy regarding cell phones, iPhones kind of thing, and how does that integrate with policy on bullying, do you think? So first of all, what is the policy regarding the use of cell phones during the school day? And second, how do you think that would work with the creating cyberbullying in statute?
So the policy at Diamond High School is that if your teacher says you are allowed to use your phone, you may use it. I know some kids who use their phone and they're not supposed to be, so people text them throughout the day. It's just something that's going to happen. And some people are thinking about the bringing your own device, and then people will be using their phones throughout the school day. And it's going to happen either way. So people are continuously using their cell phones, and it does affect the cyberbullying. For if people look at their phone, then people are to see it, and when they see it, it just affects them for the rest of the day.
Okay. So let me clarify. So you say it's up to each teacher in each class. So students will carry their phones with them, and they may be allowed to use it in one class in mathematics, but not in history. And it's kind of
yes.
Okay, interesting. So there's no policy that bans the use of cell phones throughout the entire school day, huh?
No.
Okay. Thanks.
And Representative Sadler, I might interject. Cell phones have become more than just a cell phone, fortunately, they are calendars, they are our email. They are internet, and I certainly know, sitting on the school board at the MATSU, this was a conversation that we had. Do we ban cell phones? Do we just ban calling? Do we ban texting? At what point do we recognize that the internet is here and we utilize it for research? If we can use our laptops for research, can the same thing happen via email? And it becomes a bigger conversation. And I guess that's why I'm really glad that the sponsor brought this particular conversation, because with electronics comes the opportunity to up the game that we may have played when we were kids, and that's called passing notes, and how we pass notes differently, and how we have that conversation. Some of us may have passed more notes and others did not, but that being said, I do think that the conversation is important. I lost track. I think Representative Quito, were you in the queue?
Yes, Madam Chair, and just a general comment. I appreciate Representative Seaton's comment about student that has been subject to, and I think that's an important distinction for us to consider, that if somebody has been adversely impacted by a communication, then that should be the measure of whether or not we believe there's bullying going on. So that's covered currently in statute, and all we're adding is, are they impacted negatively by electronic media, not just oral or written communication? So I think that was, for me, an important clarification. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
And kind of a comment, maybe a question at the end of it. As Representative Quito says, the statute already does clearly cover, in its terms, oral and written, oral, or physical act, when the act is undertaken with the intent, so it speaks more to intent. Just a kind of a drafting question to the sponsor. Why did you not simply just add electronic, so it would read intentional, written, electronic, or oral or physical act? Why did you add communication? Because certainly an oral act would be a communication. It's kind of a drafting thing. It's important to have the word communication there.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think it is important to include communication there, because like we saw in the Senate bill, an electronic act could be simply a post or something that's not direct communication to another person. Someone could make a blog post not intending harm to anybody, but that may be offensive to someone, but if it's not an act communicating to that person their dislike or their problem with the recipient, then it wouldn't be qualified under this bill.
So to clarify that,
please.
So a post on Facebook that is presumably broadcast to everybody, not specifically directed at Bobby or Susie, is not covered by this. You're saying communication is directed to somebody. Is an act that's directed to somebody. So I guess what I'm saying is posts on Facebook, which I know can be done from a mobile cell phone as well. So Facebook posting to the world would not be communication?
Representative Sadler, I think I'm going to direct this question to the Department of Law.
Okay. And at this time, we don't have them online. Are they in the audience? We do have some other folks online, and maybe if we could defer that question until maybe the department. Representative Sadler.
It's probably mooted me at this point just to say I also share Representative Ledoux's questions about First Amendment rights, and I don't know if it might ever be challenged, but I can see some interesting discussion during a Supreme Court discussion or any court discussion as to whether this kind of communication is protected under First Amendment or not, because I have a 15-year-old daughter, and I try to tell her that the world's a mean place. People will say things that might hurt your feelings, but that's kind of what the world is. And under the First Amendment, we do have a right to be offensive and mean.
And I think we as politicians, I think we see the same kind of cyberbullying, and it's a struggle when people bring things out that are not the truth. I think anonymously, and I certainly think that many of us have felt that cyberbullying. But I think, can you imagine in the schools? And I think just raising that conversation, having this, that was one of the reasons that I agreed to even hear this bill, because I think it's really important for us to recognize that this is a concern, and I think it's a big concern in middle school and high school. We have Ron Fuhrer on the line. Ron? Well, we had him on the line.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you, Ron. If you'll introduce yourself and who you may be with, and if you have any testimony, please go forward.
Hey, for the record, my name is Ron Fuhrer, president of NEA Alaska, and I want to testify in support of HB 45. Cyberbullying occurs in the shadows, whether online, on Facebook, by text message, or some other means. It can be more difficult to detect and prevent than more conventional forms of bullying. Teachers and education support professionals are the first line of defense in stopping cyberbullying in schools. Cyberbullying carries over to the classroom. Only 1 in 10 victims will inform a parent or trusted adult of their abuse. The consequences of cyberbullying are significant. Both traditional bullying and cyberbullying cause significant emotional and psychological distress. Like other forms of bullying, cyberbullied kids experience fear, low self-esteem, depression, and anxiety. Cyberbullying victims also experience some unique consequences, such as feeling overwhelmed, vulnerable, powerless, exposed, humiliated, isolated, and even disinterested in life. Bullying victims are 2 to 9 times more likely to consider suicide. According to Pew Research, about 1/3 of all teenagers who have used the internet have been the target of some form of cyberbullying. Some research shows nearly 43% of kids have been bullied online, 1 in 4 more than once. 70% of students report seeing frequent bullying online. Cyberbullying is unacceptable. The only way to bring cyberbullying out of the shadows is a community effort by teachers, parents, administrators, and other students to send a clear message that cyberbullying will not be tolerated. HB 45 is the first step towards ensuring Alaskan students can attend school in a safe learning environment free from the threat of cyberbullying. Please support HB 45. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fuhrer. And next we have Mike Coons. Mike, are you still online?
Ma'am, I am. This is Mike Coons. I'm from Lazy Mountain, Palmer area, and I'm speaking for myself. I oppose HB 45. Let me first talk about Sections 1 and 2. Section 1, do you mean to tell me that school staff don't intervene now? Why should a student have to report? What happens if a student doesn't, and if any discipline, and why? Then, at what level is this talking about? What is the objective definition of harassment, intimidation, or bullying? Very subjective, depending on the viewer and when they see it. heck, it could be the intended victim intimidating back to stop the bully's behavior. It could be the victim fighting back and winning over the bully. Then, of course, with this as a guideline, the bully becomes the victim and the intended victim gets the punishment. Section 2, subsection 2, again, determination depends on the viewer, as I just stated. In reading the proposed text, I am not impressed. If this is being proposed because of the cyberbullying in the lower 48 that made national news, this does little to nothing to deter such actions that lead to death of the victim. This is why we have kids that are bullied who have no skills turn to ramped up violence disproportionately over the problem. This is why we have kids with low esteem who have nowhere to go that really matters to them. In reviewing the wording, it is subjective at best, and with the history of courts, I don't believe a person on trial in a juvenile court would be found guilty for, quote, fear of physical injury, severe mental or emotional injury, or damage to person's property, end quote. How to prove the victim had that level of fear or if they suffered mental or emotional injury? I'm sure any number of psychiatrists would come up with differing views as to the victim's level of fear or emotional, mental or emotional injury, both for the defense and the prosecutor. Based on the above, this is one more law that will either be misused or ignored. We have enough of those already, and I'd love to see a time spent to repeal such laws that don't work and are done on emotion. Let me end with this. Why don't we, at the community level, not the legislative level, do something that really makes a difference? Why don't we teach not to be a victim? The NRA has, of course, refused to be a victim. This is about 95% on mental attitude, verbal options, or verbal judo, situational awareness, simple methods of defense, then upping defense with non-lethal to lethal. This is mostly taught to women and has a huge impact and a high success rate. When I was a kid, I was 6 months younger and quite a bit smaller than my peers. My dad always told me to never throw the first punch. If I could, walk away. But if I had to fight, fight to the finish and don't come home crying, then I would get disciplined, a boot on my rear end. I walked away many times and called the coward for it. I also stood up to bullies and got the second swing in. I lost more than I won over the years, but no bully bullied me more than once after we got into it. For bullies don't like to get hurt. They can dish it out, but they can't take it. Plus, they know that they may have won this time. They might not be so lucky the second. My last fight was in the 11th grade that I won and won big, and my PE teacher let it go on to the end. He told me years later he did that because he had never seen me win. What did this do for me as an adult? It taught me to stand for myself and not be a victim, and to be in control of my life. Legislation like this and others is so much fluff and makes the progressives feel good that we are doing something. When we really know what the progressives really want, a public dependent on the government and others versus the public that takes personal responsibility for themselves. Do not pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. Do we have anybody else online or in the audience? With that, we'll close public testimony. And I think we'll hold this bill. That was our original intent, although I thank Mr. Coons for his comments. As we move forward, I thank the bill sponsor for bringing the bill forward. I certainly have appreciated the conversation. I think it's important to have this conversation, as I said originally. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate this coming forward as well, because I was not really aware that the current bullying bill was a report for a student that's subjected to, instead of seeing an action and reporting a student that did something. So to me, that seems like this is a reasonable way to approach the problem, because what we're talking about throughout this section two is the effect on a student if their education is being disrupted, if it's so severe and persistent or pervasive that it's threatening their educational environment. And it's interesting that this is in the public school section 14, so that we're not talking about a crime. We're not talking about making reports to police. We're talking about making reports to the school district within the school district policies. And them. So, Madam Chair, it's been good to review this and see that, because I wasn't aware of how we had structured in the current law the reports of what bullying report was.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. And I know that some of our school districts have some policies as well. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a close reading of Section 1, Paragraph B, on line 5 of the first page, it does make clear that this bullying policy currently addresses both bullying, that someone must report, employee, student, volunteer must report if they see bullying happening, like from the bully to the victim, as well as the more passive, if you see a victim being bullied. And second, I think it's hard for us all, maybe people listening, to understand that there already is in statute a law that says policies must include reports of bullying. This simply expands the definition a half step farther from oral to include electronic.
Well done. Representative Ledoux.
I think that we've had a really good beginning discussion today. And when we hear the bill again, which I would like to, I'd really like to have a representative of the Department of Law here, because I'm struggling with the First Amendment issues. Although my struggle with the First Amendment issues may be in the law in general, as opposed to simply adding the electronic in them.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Costello.
Thank you, and members of the committee.
Thanks. And next we'll hear the bill sponsor for House Bill 365, Representative Seaton. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the committee's taking up this bill today. This was brought to me by school counselors, and it's got a fairly high number because I wasn't really aware of the extent of this until the last month. But House Bill 365 addresses the Alaska Performance Scholarship, which, as you know, we created that in 2010. And the students are currently eligible to receive the scholarship if they meet the requirements of one of three tiers of awards, and that's laid out in your packet. And the criteria for the awards include the completion of a rigorous curriculum, grade point average requirements, and the standardized examination. Those standardized examinations are used for all three awards are ACT, the SAT, or the WorkKeys test. And the WorkKeys examination is designed for entry into career and technical fields. And what I became aware of here was that many of the career paths for these career and technical fields are an Associate of Arts degree. And yet, students that go through our school system, and that goes all the way down to middle school, where we use KeyTrain, and there are some other aligned curriculum for career and technical education, taking rigorous courses, going through the process, and then they take the WorkKeys examination, but they can only use that for a certificate program. And so the problem is that many of the career paths that we have in what we consider career and technical education are through an Associate of Arts degree instead of, or an Associate's, and let's see, I forget the other name, but anyway, the Associate's, the two-year Associate's degree. So what I'm hoping that this bill will do is allow students that go through the career technical pathway and get the work keys to be able to pursue their career technical goal through either the certificate or a associate's degree and use their scholarship, because right now we have students that qualify for the APS but then if they go to the university for an associate's degree, they don't get their scholarship or can't use it. And I think that we are passing the idea of having the APS so that we will encourage students to go on to further their education and to qualify in these career and technical fields. So, Madam Chair, in your support documents, you have in the packet a whole list from the University of Alaska of 2 pages of associate's degrees, and you can see on many of those whether they're industrial technology or air traffic control, automotive technology, those are associates of applied science degrees, which are, you know, those entryways. Sometimes it's not a certificate, sometimes it's an associate's degree that's needed. So, Madam Chair, although the bill is drafted just saying that you can use it for a degree, the intent was not to say this is the pathway for a bachelor's and master's, those kind of things. This is the pathway for career and technical, but we've excluded one of the main things that we've developed over time for career technical entry, which is the Associates of Arts degree in many of those fields.
And thank you, Representative Seaton. And I know there's a large voice out there for parents and students wanting career and technical options. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. Representative Ledoux.
So wouldn't going to a technical school, wouldn't the examination necessary for going to a technical school be considered a college entrance exam?
Madam Chair, Representative Ledoux, the use of the SAT or ACT or work keys as an examination was felt necessary because we don't really have control over the grade point averages at each different district across the state, and to make sure we weren't qualifying for scholarships by lowering the standards, the grade point standards in schools, you still had to qualify by having some, demonstrate that you have a certain skill level, and those are set by the school board of what levels you need to pass on those exams. Really, the SAT and the ACT aren't used by many schools, including the University of Alaska. The University of Alaska uses the AccuPlacer to place kids in the appropriate classes. So although they once were much more considered the thing that you needed to do to go to college, there was just a report that over 800 universities across the United States no longer require either the SAT or ACT. So I don't want to get into saying that SAT, ACT are necessary for as college entrance exams, because in here it's the AccuPlacer that is used for placing people and finding out whether they need developmental courses. So I don't know if I answered your question completely.
Can I just follow up?
Just a moment. And Representative Seaton, I know that when I sat in the Education Subfinance Committee and had Diane Barron speak to this and we had some questions, she did an excellent job of explaining. I know that she is in the audience, and I would like to bring her forward because she did a good job just basically outlining to us what the performance scholarship did and didn't do and what levels. And I learned a lot from a presentation or a brief one that she had, and I think that that's probably important for this group to kind of understand where we're at and what it is that you're trying to do to move it forward. And maybe she could speak to that as she's coming forward, and I appreciate it.
You want?
Yeah, you could just sit right next to her, but I know she did a great job. It clarified a lot for me just a month or so ago, so thank you, Diane. If you'll put yourself on the record.
Certainly. Thank you for the record. My name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Through the chair to your question, Representative Ledoux, The work keys assessment, and I'm not an assessment expert. We have folks in the audience who can probably speak to that more precisely, is not a college entrance exam. Work keys is designed to assess an individual's readiness to enter the workforce.
Thank you.
And could you just give us a brief briefing, if you will, on what the performance scholarship does for those going on to a four-year degree versus those going on to a vocational? And I think that was where that vocational aspect is where I learned a lot this year in regards to the performance scholarship. And what I'm thinking Representative Seaton is doing is kind of filling that particular vocational gap.
Certainly. Madam Chair, the Alaska Performance Scholarship as it currently exists really does have two tracks. One is the degree track, which is governed, if you will, in terms of award eligibility by college entrance exam scores, which are the SAT and ACT. With the State Board of Education Early Development in setting the standards for the career track, focused on sort of a minimum single benchmark for all award levels. Currently, that's a work key score of 13, maximum score on a work keys for the components that are included is a 20. So they actually let the GPA govern the award level. But because of that, in order to give wide access to students to that track, they went with the single scoring benchmark and limited the programs to certificate programs, because I believe the rationale is there are components to associate's programs that are general education that really need to be assessed for academic preparedness into a degree program. So associates really combine both the technical aspects with a broader general education requirement and without assessing the student's ability to succeed at that, they focus on directing those students for certificate programs.
Any questions? Well, we've got her on the hot seat. Representative Reinbold.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Gattis. Basically, what my question is I looked at the costs. So basically, the first level is basically $4,700, and then it goes down to $3,500 and then $2,378 for the award levels, the amount awarded. If these were included, I don't know how long these programs are. I don't know how much they take. I don't know if they're a two-week. I don't know if they're year, 2 year. I mean, is this the appropriate award level for these? And also, I looked at the fiscal note, and it looks like it's going to cost between $1 and $2 million a year, roughly.
We'll ask the first question first.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Reinbold. In terms of the award levels, they were originally designed based against the existing tuition for a full-time student at the University of Alaska. So that was what was used to set those levels originally. With respect to the actual cost of the certificate program, you are correct that they may be anywhere from 10 weeks to a year in length. Typically, some are longer, but that's a good general length. The student can have up to the amount of their award, but it may not exceed the cost of the program. So if it's a short course program that costs less than that, they can't receive more than the cost of attending the program.
Okay. Representative Reinbold, your second question, please. Okay,
well, basically, so I don't know how many people are going to be able to potentially take advantage of this, but you only anticipate a $1 to $2 million annual fiscal note?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it's actually difficult to do the fiscal analysis on this. What I did was I looked at the, we do know that there are a couple of hundred students from the class of 13 who qualified for a work keys APS, Alaska Performance Scholarship, who, because they enrolled in an associate's degree or a degree program, were not able to use those. So, you know, I took that number as the number that may be actually qualifying and continuing on, and just used the cost associated with funding those students if they actually received the award.
And I think that was the interesting part that we talked about in our sub-finance committee, that I just wasn't aware that some of these folks did not have that opportunity. And, and I wasn't part of the original conversation when this performance scholarship came up and really gotten into the weeds like maybe Representative Seaton had. So it was a learning experience on my part. Representative Reinbold.
Okay, thank you, Chair Geddes. So basically what I would like to know is, one more time, how many students and then how many more you think would potentially take advantage of this?
Through the Chair, Representative Reinbold, that's the part that it's hard to estimate. We don't know what number of students qualified for an APS but elected not to go to school because they wanted to go to a degree program and the APS was not available to them for that. So that's an unknown element in this. What we did was we looked at the number who, in spite of the fact that they were unable to use the Alaska Performance Scholarship, proceeded to enroll in a degree program at the University of Alaska.
And what was that number?
It was 202, I believe. The other thing to bear in mind is that those are students who qualified with work key score based on the current minimal level. This would need the, were this bill to pass, this would have to go back to the State Board of Education. They would have to consider what, going forward, what work key scores should be considered high, medium, and below medium to qualify for these three awards. So that's a whole conversation that would have to take place, and I understand that there is some analysis to see, what is there a way to compare work key scores to, in an equivalent sort of way, to ACT and SAT, and I think that's going to be where there's a great deal of challenge, because one assesses college readiness while the other is not designed to do so.
And could it safely be said that there would be more kids that would look at this, career portion, if this bill were to pass? How many more? I know that that's tough to answer, but is it safe to say that there would be more?
To the contrary, Madam Chair, I think that they might look at it. Aspire to it, which would be a good thing, but
right.
Because I suspect the cut scores would be increased in order to ensure the students were actually ready to proceed into an academic setting, that fewer would actually qualify.
And I guess I should have qualified my questions, assuming that we don't make those particular changes, that if everything were equal, it's hard to say, and I understand where you're coming from. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Interesting. I'm glad you asked that question, because I was thinking it would be fair to assume that if the APS were extended to cover vocational certificates, two-year degrees, rather, that more students would obviously take advantage of it. And so I was going to ask you some fiscal note questions there, too. I would note that it's also under some – it's not quite clear yet what state law will be at the end of this session regarding what assessments will be required of students in Alaska and at whose expense. And so – there's the other large factor. You don't know if it's going to be required of everybody and paid for by the state, or whether it's going to be limited to just those who have the money to do it themselves at their parents' expense. So that's one factor. But I almost don't know if this is a better question to ask the Department of Education. And I don't know, Ms. Behrens, if you were involved in it, but in your opinion, is this consistent with the original intent of the Alaska Performance Scholarship? Does this change it? Was this considered at the start of that program? I don't know if you were there for that. I know you're there, but I'm not sure if you're involved in it.
I was, through the Chair, Representative Sadler. These are the sort of granular details of implementation that I don't believe were fully discussed relative to the distinction between a certificate and an associate program. The commitment that was made was that there would be options for both a collegiate track and a career technical education track, and I believe it's in that spirit that the State Board took this action. I was not privy to the discussions that the board engaged in around setting the score and taking this approach, but I know that there are representatives from the department in the audience.
Senator Sadler.
And thank you. Let me put a fine point on it, too. I'm not sure if I heard. Do you support this legislation?
I would have concerns about the legislation as currently drafted, because as the sponsor indicated, you know, it appears that this suggests a very wide broadening to any degree track, when it might be more finely tooled to focus on those that we know work keys a score could ensure some preparedness for, which would be perhaps a subset of the very long list of associate programs. I think there's within the list of programs that the sponsor has provided, there's a wide list or a wide variance of the academic requirements within those associate programs. I think we just have to have a better understanding.
Mm-hmm. So what I think I'm hearing say, though we still want to go down that true academic versus certificate type track, so either an AA or a bachelor's, but more importantly, more of that college track versus the certificate. Is that what I'm hearing? Again, I wasn't part of the conversation with the original performance scholarship, and so I'm thinking that's what I always thought, that it was part of getting kids to either take a vocational course and go down that road, or college readiness in college, and I'm hearing it kind of, we still want to have that college focus.
Well, we do, Madam Chair, but I think within the context of the training structure in the programs, it's gotten a little bit blurry. That because there's been an interest in creating articulated pathways where a student can take a certificate and then maybe move on to an associate and then build on that into a baccalaureate program, that the structure of the programs are not as clear cut between career technical and academic.
And very well said. Thank you. Representative Quito.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of more of a clarification on an existing statute that I was wondering, and you may have kind of answered it, and maybe you need to pass it on to the department. But in each one of these categories, we talk about the minimum score, so very high minimum score, and then the high minimum score, and the moderately high minimum score. Are those scores that are defined by the State Board of Education?
Through the Chair, Representative Quito, that's correct.
Okay.
Those are set in regulation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we talk about these things, I think we really need to recognize that about 30% of our kids go on and prepare in school as if they're going to college, and what we're trying to do is increase post-secondary education, and we have an entire curriculum that we've developed throughout the state to try to prepare people to go on to post-secondary education. And, you know, a lot of our students are going through that career track education system, but they still have to take the rigorous courses. They still have to take that rigorous coursework to be able to qualify for the ATS. So the question is, since so many of our career tracks now require an associate's or associates of applied sciences, should we be directing them through and keeping them involved in school through a career technical education in high school, taking the work keys, and then saying, oh, well, yes, your aspirations are a little higher, but now you can't use the scholarship? And that's what we're trying to get over here, so that many of these associate's degrees are aligned to furthering career technical education, and that's a goal. Although this says just degree programs, my intention is not to say that this is now becoming the directed track for someone that's going to a 4-year college.
Right, and I think I understand that. I guess where I personally am struggling is with the performance scholarship, what the intent of the performance scholarship was and is. And I certainly believe that we have, I'm just going to say it, I think we as a state have failed in our vocational portion, and I think that we're playing catch-up right now. And I know folks in my district, we have a career in tech school that I think that is part of playing catch-up. And I think traveling the bush, I think that is one of the things that they raise their hand and struggle with, that at one time they had some voc ed portions that they no longer have. And so I think as the state as a whole is looking for vocational opportunities. Now, whether this is the right place to put it or not, that's where I'm struggling with. And so I certainly understand, I guess, the fact that the performance scholarship may have had a particular mission and whether we're piggybacking on that mission. And I think that's what Ms. Behrens was indicating, that we've certainly kind of blurred the lines, and possibly on purpose. No, and I get that. I guess the question is, are we intentionally wanting to blur those lines to get vocational ed folks on board? And I think that's truly the question that I think Representative Seaton is asking, and I'm putting words in his mouth, but where we stand with vocational ed. We do have the department here as well, and we do have some invited testimony. So, Representative Seaton, if you'd like to tell me which one you'd like to use next, we'll go there.
Madam Chair, we have a couple of counselors on that could probably tell us, you know, why this is necessary within our educational system to, you know, move students forward. So I think we have LaDawn Drews from the Nanilchik School Counselor first.
Right, and we only have LaDawn at this point. So LaDawn, are you with us?
Hi, Representative Gaddis. This is LaDawn Drews from the Nanilchik School.
Thank
you. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm here in my counseling office at the school with about seven of our wonderful students here with our junior senior class that did submit testimony to you in writing regarding House Bill 365. And I wanted to clarify, and I appreciate Representative Seaton taking the chair there this morning and clarifying the bill. Apparently, we did misunderstand the intent that our understanding was the work he scored potentially to go toward the collegiate track of a bachelor's program, which is apparently not the intent. But I would suggest that their testimony is still valid, because obviously if they felt potentially the work keys could be used toward collegiate bachelor degree, then they obviously feel that it should be used toward the associate's degree, more along the career tech ed track. So I would ask that you not dismiss their testimony, because apparently we did misunderstand the nuances there of that particular bill. And I would like to say that for particularly that associate's applied science degree, which is quite popular here on the Kenai Peninsula with our Kenai Peninsula College campus offering the two-year degree in process tech and instrument tech, which several of the students here in my office today are actually looking at. The WorkEase option for that particular program would be much appreciated. As Representative Seaton stated, the curriculum is still fairly rigorous for that CTE track as well, and the students are doing a good job getting through that. And, of course, their GPA has to be at that particular level also across the board. But oftentimes the SAT, ACT throws up some barriers for them in terms of accessibility of taking the test, cost of taking the test, opportunity to study for the test, and quite honestly, some students just are not good standardized.
Whoops, we lost LaDawn. I think that if she comes back on, hopefully she'll know where she left off. It was a pretty good testimony. We have the department here, and if we could get Les Morse to come up, and I've noticed that he said for questions only, but we don't want him to miss that opportunity to sit here in this hot seat and see if we do have some questions for you. If you'll please put yourself on the record.
Les Morris, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development.
And do we have any questions for him? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'll start us off, Mr. Morris, with the same question. Is this proposed change in this legislation consistent with the original intent of the Alaska Performance Scholarships? Was this considered and rejected, or is this something you hadn't thought might be doable?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there was a lot of discussion when this was passed around career opportunities and particular certificate programs as well as degree-seeking programs. So does it match the original intent? I'd really probably go back and spend time looking at the record. But there was certainly interest in advancing both degree-seeking programs as well as students moving into careers. The one piece that was very strong in the intent that I can speak to, though, was trying to encourage more rigorous preparation at the secondary level before students go either route, whether it be a certificate program or into a degree-seeking program, because regardless of which direction students have gone, again, to a university degree or to a certificate, the intent was to increase the rigor so their preparation is solid enough that in either route they have a greater chance for success, whether and reduction of remediation, whether that be at the university or in a technical institute. So that was a big piece of the original intent, was around preparation in secondary school and raising the standards and the rigor at that level. And then all I can speak to in the second part is there was a great deal of discussion around that. And so I think the governor probably put forward this originally to get students into degrees, but there was a great deal of discussion about the value of certificates as well to go in right into career programs.
I can just add parenthetically that I also think it's a good idea to raise the rigor of curriculum. I think it's a good positive way to reinforce students for taking on bigger challenges in high school. Again, as you say, regardless of what their eventual academic or vocational track might be, I think up in the game in high school helps you no matter which way you go.
And I guess the obvious question is, do you think this bill continues allowing that rigor to stay in the equation, whether they shift over to a vocational aspect or over to a four-year degree or, as Ms. Behrens indicated, a baccalaureate-type degree? Does that rigor still stay in according to this bill, in your opinion?
Chair Gaddis, I'd have a couple of concerns. The first is the bill, and actually the sponsor talked about the intent of the bill. Right now the language doesn't completely match that intent, just because under the current language, I think this would open it up, the way I read it, for baccalaureate degrees. And I didn't hear that as the intent, nor do I think it provides the appropriate information for us to know those students are prepared for that. So let me just put that on the table first. Then does it help advance that? I think we're primarily looking at associate degree programs at the university that are primarily career-oriented and not toward baccalaureate and master's. That's going with the intent, not necessarily the language that I read. And I think, well, not automatically opposed to that, I certainly think it deserves some deeper examination, and this is why. Some of those associate programs really do have a pretty rigorous math, language, arts, and literature background necessary. And the work key simply doesn't give you that information to say, will you make it through that curriculum? Whereas the SAT and ACT do provide better information regarding that. And the last thing that I think we want to be caught in is a situation where one of the other goals is to reduce the remediation rate. We don't want students going into those associate programs and requiring remediation. So we really probably have to examine, is it the whole set of associates or is it a subset of those associates that are the appropriate ones, and what are the true requirements when you arrive so that you're not taking, we're not moving people into something that they're not prepared for. And the course requirements do part of that, but the cross-check really is that state score, because that's the only, or the SAT, ACT score, because that's the only thing we can monitor statewide. Even though we put in curriculum in place, the state can't truly tell us was Algebra 2 in Juneau the same as Algebra 2 in any other location, regardless of where that might be. So,
which I might say in itself is, it makes a statement right there. You know, the fact that we do not have that same type of curriculum throughout the state, so that Algebra 2 in Juneau is the same as Algebra 2 in the Mat-Su. So there's another challenge that has nothing to do with this. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there were a number of us around the table that weren't here for that, the construction of that. And looking at the data and data since that is nationally available, you know, GPA and the rigorousness of the curriculum that's taken in high school is the best determiner of success. I mean, and that's why the program that was adopted phased in, so that you went from, you know, it was originally only 1 year of math, now 2 years, 3 years of math, and then, you know, when it's fully implemented, 4 years of math, science. So both tracks require a rigorous curriculum. Both tracks rely on GPA. And I just want to make sure that we're not considering that because you were a student who was interested in career technical fields, and so you wouldn't have gone on to school, probably. You'd be probably that 70-75% of kids that don't go on to post-secondary education if you hadn't had the career track in high school, and that we penalize them by saying, okay, you qualified for this by taking the rigorous curriculum, which you didn't have to graduate from high school.
Right.
You took the rigorous curriculum, you got GPA that qualified you, you took a test that made sure that there was some equivalency of what that GPA meant across the state, but you can't use it for a career technical degree if it's an associate degree. You can only use it if it's a certificate. And so, Madam Chair, that's the part that we're trying to get over here. And you know, I fully admit that the way the bill was drafted up, it was kind of quick to get it in by the deadline, and it just says degrees. And I would even move as we go through the bill to make that associate's degrees.
Right.
I'm not sure that we want to go down the track of saying that we have to have cut score, that if you use work keys, we guarantee that you won't have to take any developmental courses or something, because our level 3 SAT score, 40% of those kids have to take developmental courses, remedial courses, when they go to college. So we're trying to get people moved along, give them an opportunity to go to college. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It doesn't mean that every one of those is at the top of the field, because obviously they had to have a 2.5 or better GPA. But the whole goal here is to move kids through into post-secondary education and get a more qualified, more highly qualified workforce. So that's the intent of this, Madam Chair, and I'm perfectly willing to take amendments and suggestions from the department as we
Right, and Representative Seaton, certainly you and I are both on the same side when it comes to the vocational aspect, and we've spoken before. One of the challenges that I have just listening and having this conversation is if this performance scholarship is certainly based on GPAs, but then at the same time we're talking about the tests that we test, like the SAT, and we have a low percentage that does well on the SAT, something is not right here. So either it's the GPAs, it's the courses that we give, or those less than rigorous courses. But if we have kids going for remedial help in our university settings, but they have high GPAs, then we do have cut scores or curriculum that doesn't transfer, if you will. So I mean, there is a we do have something that is not right here. So and I think that is one of the concerns. We have LaDawn back online, and she had indicated that she had a room full of students, and so I don't want to hold them up from going to school. So LaDawn.
Yes, Chair Gaddis, thank you so much. I don't know at what point in the testimony there. We lost the call, but I do have some students here. There is an assembly that is going on in our school, but right now they've stayed here to answer any questions that you might have of them. But I, again, appreciate the clarification. And as Representative Seaton stated, I also believe that the GPA and the curriculum is a better indicator of success post-secondary than a standardized test. And I think that's been proven out several times. But if there's any questions of the students here, I would turn it over to them.
And I'm not sure if this is a question for the students or yourself, but Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Actually, that's a question for the counselor. I did notice that the support packet included a number of student letters from students at your school. Just curious, did you encourage them or require them to send in letters, or was this under their own volition or suggestion?
Thank you for the question, Representative Sadler, through the chair. A counselor in our district brought this to all the counselors in the district's attention. That she had been visiting with Representative Seaton about this and then provided us a copy of the bill. I merely suggested it. There's a government class that these students are in right now to their instructor and just provided a little bit of background information about it, gave them a copy of the bill, and I believe the instructor then encouraged them to write these letters, and I didn't provide any undue influence as to how they should feel about it. They're all living this right now, actually, as juniors and seniors. So they did all submit, I believe, their testimony through a government class.
I just wanted to compliment the students for taking the initiative to write letters and express your thoughts on it. It's good to get involved in public affairs at a young age. And I look forward to hearing I look forward to those who are brave enough to come to the phone or microphone and share the thoughts live on tape or live in person.
And LaDawn, we do have the time if they would like to step forward and just give a comment or two.
I do have one student here. He's a senior, and because obviously this clearly affects him, but
And if he'll step forward and introduce his name, introduce himself for the record.
Okay, very good.
Hello, my name is Robert Delgado, a senior here. And thank you all for taking the time to listen to me today. I just think that the goal of this scholarship here is to help kids stay in Alaska to get an education. And I believe that using this work keys for the career tech ed and the associate's degree instead of the SAT, ACT score will help those who perhaps aren't quite as good test takers to get this scholarship. And it would help keep it the main purpose of the scholarship to keep people in Alaska. And I think that's all I have to say right now on the matter, but thank you very much for listening.
Well said, Mr. Delgado. Thank you for testifying. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Robert, just a brief question. Do the students know among yourselves who is pursuing the curriculum track that requires the more rigorous classes to qualify for the Alaska Performance Scholarship? Do you all know, who's pursuing that or not?
We all are.
Good man.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you, LaDawn, and your group for calling in and listening. Do we have anybody in the audience that would like to speak to this bill? I don't see anybody else online, so at this point we'll close public testimony, and we'll bring it back to the committee. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did want to ask Mr. Morse from the department just the basic question. Does the department support this legislation as written, or would you like to see amendments, or I'd just like to put that ball question to you.
Yes, and we let him go a little bit early only because we had kids online, and thank you. If you'll put yourself back on the record, please.
Again, Les Morse, Deputy Commissioner, Alaska Department of Education, Early Development. I appreciate taking time for the kids, having taught and been a principal. They have other duties on their day. You want me to address
this?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. I think I addressed the concerns that we have earlier. Really, I think the intent mentioned is different than the way we're reading the language, and I think that is an issue. And I think we need to have a good discussion and some thinking around the requirements of associate's degrees around the mathematics, language arts, and literature, and if they're different for different associate's degrees, because the biggest concern I would have is having students move forward and move into an associate degree that they really don't have what they need at the secondary level to be successful getting through that full program. So, and I don't, you know, the Work Keys is an assessment really around job skills assessment for jobs. It's not about are you prepared for college mathematics, college language arts, and English. And so I just wouldn't want us to make a decision in haste that doesn't have us thinking through how do we be the good stewards of this program and the dollars. So I just think this is right for a lot more conversation and closer examination than to say that we can support it as it is.
Representative Sadler.
Another question. I want a different topic, I guess. Could you speak to the fiscal note? Diane Behrens did speak a little bit to it, but have you any thoughts as to the accuracy or how that might, if we delved in deeper, if it might change one way, the up or down?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there are two fiscal notes. One was done by the commission, the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. We provided data for them to work with because we're the holders of the student data and the test scores, and we provided data. So I think I won't speak to that fiscal note any further than what she did because I think the assumptions she made as they prepared that with the data we provided, to me, make good sense as the best way you can get to providing information about it. There is a second fiscal note from the department that is for fairly limited study, but it's $35,000 one-time money only because it would be around doing some analysis and some study to make sure that we could provide the board good information about setting what the cut score ought to be. I think the board will want to know, well, how does these various work key scores relate, if they relate, to the current cuts established for the ACT and SAT? And that's simply information that would require some limited study, so we put that forward. Now, what we'd be able to do is say, where's the statistical match? If a student had the right preparation, how would they do on the SAT relative to the work keys? However, if you walk away and don't have the appropriate preparation, you might not get that same score. But our intent behind that fiscal note is to do some correlation study to provide the state board information so that they could make an educated decision on cuts.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, obviously from our discussion, I'm glad we're having it. We want to get together with the committee and the department and make this aligned to what the intent is, because I think that gets many of our students going on and being able to stay in state and progress their education. And the thing that I am looking at are the cut scores, because everybody that took the SAT, we also have their work key scores. The department does, because everyone was at least required to take the work keys in the 11th grade, and those that chose to could also take the ACT or SAT, probably as a senior. Probably those kids didn't go back, like some of the kids that are doing work keys, in the 12th grade to improve their score and their standing on work keys, which is used by employers. I would hope that we have the ability to do that analysis. I'm not trying to set a cut score here. I think that's for the department and the board, State Board of Education, to look at whether there's appropriate different cut scores in all of these programs. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quito.
Thank you, Chair Gaddis. I think what I'm trying to understand a little bit more is there's rigorous curriculum required in order to qualify for the scholarship, and that's identified in statute with the amount of mathematics and science. And I'm trying to understand whether or not that actually is beneficial towards somebody going for a certificate or an associate's degree program. And it seems as though there might be an opportunity here, maybe by separating the certificate and AA associate's degree programs out from the performance scholarship, maybe creating another opportunity for the students that are going towards those programs. Because I think the way the curriculum is identified in statute, it really seems to be driven towards the four-year baccalaureate. And I'm wondering if we create a lot of confusion by mixing the two. So I guess I'm thinking it might be worthwhile to get a little bit more input from the department on whether or not there are standards that could be identified for a certificate or an associate's degree program that could create a program that would be useful for those students going into those programs.
And Representative Quito, that good information, certainly that we've heard the bill sponsor tell us that he's willing to work with the department, and we were not intending to pass the bill out today. There's a little bit of work that I think that the bill sponsors indicated that we could clarify, so good information. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, and I guess this is more of a general question. We've got a few minutes here. Mr. Morris, if you just give us your thoughts or experience with the work keys. It's not a tool I'm real familiar with, so just any thoughts or information that you think might be helpful for us to understand about it?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the work keys, and I'd be happy to provide some more information. We've got like a brochure that's a really quick read, and I think maybe I'll get that to the committee chair to distribute.
You know, I'm curious. We have talked work keys this whole time through. We've talked a lot of it. Is there a way that we could take that work keys test? I'm serious. I think that we've talked a lot about it. I have no idea what's really on that. I've certainly never taken it. But because we pin a lot of things to work keys, I have no idea. As an employer, as an adult, I think like to think successful at times. But what does that work keys test? I just wonder what it would say about me. Or maybe I don't want to know. But seriously, is there an opportunity for folks to take it?
Chair Gaddis, my memory serves me correctly. Actually, Representative Seaton might be able to help me refresh my memory. I think about 5 years ago, the Education Committee, when Representative Seaton was chairing it, either took it or at least did practice tests, one or the other, and I thought they did it. So it is available to take. And so it'd be easy to look at the practice tests and see what kinds of items are there. But I think there was some arrangement of actually taking the assessment. And I think we provided some information so people could individually go on do that on their own. But I think we did some work around the within committee time as well. And we can certainly provide more in-depth information. But just to say this about work keys, it provides good information to help you think about what are the careers that might be out there for me and what other things could I do to get ready for that career. The work keys is aligned to thousands of different workforce career opportunities. And that's the beauty of that particular assessment. It really helps you think about the career piece. It doesn't say that you can just move into that career. It says if you continue on this path and take the preparation to move into that career, you're really on a path to that career. So it's certainly when a junior takes it, doesn't say they can be a pipe fitter. It says if you continue on the path, take this preparation work, that's a real appropriate or something that you have alignment to skills to move toward. So, and again, I'll provide the chair some couple brochures that I think give a nice summary of it that is used with students, used with parents, and would give you the committee a nice background.
And if you will, beyond that, I'm serious. How can we take the work keys?
I'll provide.
And how long
data
does
on
it take?
I'll get all of that information for you and provide it.
Because
it
I don't, I think this question is going to be ongoing, at least for me, and I would like to take the work keys, see what I'm ready for in my when I grow up.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Seaton.
You know, if we think work keys is easy, you may as well dismiss that idea right now.
Okay, well, never mind then. No, seriously.
No, because what it is much of it is looking at mathematics skills, let's say mathematics skills, but looking at mathematics skills in a problem-solving environment that would revolve around something you were doing. One of the questions that I remember was, you're a sewage treatment operator. I forget what kind of engineer they call it now, but sewage treatment operator, and you've got to order your chlorine for next year, and here's how many gallons a day you have, here's the concentrations you need, and it's a series. Instead of ACT being looking at, okay, here's a formula you have to, it's much more rigorous involved in the idea of working through that through a actual physical problem that you would be working with in the career that you'd be looking at. So it's interesting, and I think it would be very beneficial to all of us, again, to do that.
Representative Seaton, did you take it?
I did. I didn't get to the end where I got a score. Thank
you. Right. He knew where I was going to go. I don't even want to ask why you didn't get to that point, but, maybe that ought to be something all legislators should take before they can run. I'm not sure. But, no, seriously, thank you, and I look forward to that information. WorkKeys has been spoken about a lot this year, and I really just don't know what's on that test. And as we continue forward, I think that's important. And Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the things, on a rigorous curriculum and 4 years of math, the difference of some of these tracks are that, pre-calculus is not something that a lot of, it's just totally a mind game, okay, a mind exercise. Whereas if you're on a career track, you may be taking other mathematics that are going to be, you still have to take 4 years, but you'll be using other mathematics, or you may even be taking economics or some other portion that is more related to real world type applications. And so it doesn't mean that you're not having to take the same amount of work. They're different thought alignment processes.
Well, and I think many of us have taken courses in school in which we've really never utilized that information again because we took a different track. I look at some folks, I'm appalled that they got out of high school, and it's not because they don't know pre-calc. I mean, there's some kids that have passed pre-calc, but, the actual thinking, and when you discussed, real-life solutions, whether it be looking for volumes for paint because you're going to paint the interior of something, or you're looking at yard goods when you're remodeling or so on and so forth, those kids that are excellent at math couldn't make the determination how they do this kind of real-world function. So sometimes there is a disconnect between these higher-end courses and how they relate to everyday living. So with that, we're going to hold the bill. We'll meet not this next coming Monday. Please note that Monday has been canceled, and we'll meet again on Wednesday, same time, same place. So with that, the Education Committee is now adjourned.